Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another great episode that we have for you here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and I am joined back here with my co-host, Matt McElreath, who took last Friday off. And I'll tell you what, we got a great show for you tonight. We're going to have authors Brett King and Andrew Gross on the show for you tonight.
Yeah, hey, everyone. Glad to be back. Happy Tuesday to you. And as always, we will also talk about some books we think you should pick up, recommend. And, of course, at the end of the show, we will have the ever-popular Suspense Smackdown. And today we're going to talk, or debate, I should say, Agatha Christie versus Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, kind of compared Sherlock Holmes to maybe some of Agatha's characters. So get ready for 60 minutes of Suspense Radio, and it starts right now.
All right, everybody, so another great Tuesday evening we have here for you on August the 10th. It's great to have Matt back, and Matt missed, you know, Friday's show, and so I want to kind of recap for those of you who might have, you know, be listening tonight and might have missed Friday's show. We had author Stephen James, who has his newest book out called The Bishop, along with his previous three, The Pawn, The Rook, and The Knight, and we also talked with J.T. Ellison, who has her book out, The Immortals. And so it was a great show. They were lit up. I mean, they were just, it was electric in there on Friday night with our SmackDown that was also Exorcist and Jaws, which was really quite funny because we had JT going for the Exorcist or going for Jaws and then switching it over to the Exorcist. So we kind of had a lot of fun with that one. And so the show.
Also remind people, John, just that if you miss a show, you can always go back to Blog Talk Radio and check it out.
That's true. I guess maybe you should use a teleprompter for this because there's so many things sometimes that I kind of miss. The one thing, let me tell everybody here also, is that the phone number to call in tonight, if you want to talk with Brett King, who's going to be on here in about 6 minutes, the phone number is 877-666-9320. But you can also log in here to the chat room. That seems to be really the best way. A lot of questions are being asked us through the chat room. So why don't we go ahead right now, Matt? I know that you were off on Friday. Let's see. What kind of book reviews do you have tonight? Anything going on?
Actually, I don't have any books to talk about tonight. I was going to talk about a little more some current events. A lot of people might not be aware of.
You want me to do my book reviews first, and then we'll call into the current event here thing?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, why don't I do that first? Why don't I do the book review, because I know that we were talking about that current event earlier. So I'm going to go first here. I'm going to have a double take instead of a trifecta that I normally do. And the first book that I have was sent to us by an author. His name is Lee Molin, and his book is called Once Upon a Nightmare. And this is listed as the fiction horror. And Lee does a great job here of setting up a great imaginary-ish kind of world here and setting this fiction horror category. And he puts on there that this wasn't an ordinary nightmare, because the book kind of takes you through from back in England's Whitechapel and kind of a little bit more, you know, current day kind of thing. But Lee does a great job here of writing a book, and you can pick this up on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com and wherever else you find books, because it's another winner from an author that you might not know about. The second book that I have here is from Richard Hawk, and this is called House of Secrets. He's also the author of Speak of the Devil, and this is a political thriller, espionage crime. And so, you know, Richard has been getting great reviews of this. It's in hardback, and the book just came out not too long ago, so I know it's out for everyone. And anybody who's into, you know, political thrillers and spy espionage, who's always looking for something different outside, I would definitely want you to say go find Richard Hawk here on House of Secrets. So those are the two that I have tonight. And so, Matt, why don't you go ahead and mention, you know, the current event that we're talking about?
Yeah, since I didn't do my homework, right?
Exactly. You know, your dog ate your book, but that's okay.
Well, I just thought people should be aware of kind of, we talk a lot about ebooks and the trends that relate to that, and Dorchester Publishing has decided to exclusively go with just ebooks, no more of their printed versions, and I'm kind of interested to see how that's going to play out. I mean, there's definitely a significant portion of readers who don't want to transition, but, you know, so my question to you, John, is, are they closing themselves off, or is the issue of cost just too much for them to ignore?
Well, you know, I think that it has to do a little bit about both, because when you read a little further, they're not going to be printing the books like they had just in mass market and sending it out. They're going to be doing print on demand only. So if bookstores say, okay, we want to order 10 of this book, they're still going to print them and send them out, but they're a lot smarter. And I think it is a lot smarter to be able to say, we're just not going to print 50,000 copies of a book and then have 25,000 copies of them coming back, because now they've just wasted money on printing them. And I think that ebook, we've talked about this, is that ebook is definitely the wave of the future. And to see a company like Dorchester, who's been around for a very long time, take that leap of faith, it's going to be interesting to see in the next, I guess, you know, 3, 6, 9 months on how they do. I think that's going to be the run.
Yeah, and I also, a lot of people might be sitting there saying, well, I don't want to have to shell out the money for the Kindle or Barnes & Noble's Nook or things of that nature. I also was reading that there's a price war going on these ebook readers, so definitely keep an eye out there for the prices to come down. They've been reducing, but they're probably going to come down even more, so they're definitely more affordable. It's something that we should all keep in mind.
Right. I think that they're starting to be almost like TVs, where many different manufacturers now, when you have Sony and you have Amazon, you have Barnes & Noble, and you have a couple others, I could see if this becomes more popular, you're going to see other companies coming out with their reader form, and then you're going to see the prices drop even further. So I can definitely see that there's going to be even more competition in that realm of readers. Because, heck, you can get the reader on your iPod Touch. It's kind of small, but you can still get the app for that. I know you have an iPhone. You can get the app, and we've looked at it before. You can get the reader right on your computer. So the Kindle and the e-book reader and the Nook are a lot more portable. But if somebody wants to put it right on their computer and pay $1.99 for a book, then maybe they don't feel cheated, I guess, to say, hey, you know what, I only spent $1.99, but it wasn't the greatest book. But I don't think, and I'm just going to segue right now into this, because I don't think that that's an issue at all about people not liking this book, is with our guest that's on the show here. Let's just bring him on, Brett King in The Radix. But he said, you know, you can pronounce it any way you want if you buy it. So I want to go ahead and say, Brett, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. How you doing?
Hey, guys, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I love your magazine, love your show. So thanks so much, John and Matt. I'm honored to be here tonight.
Great, and the check's in the mail. The check's in the mail for that.
Well, I should have said even more if I would have known that.
Well, then I'll give you Batman, like, $250, so there you go.
All right, there you go.
Well, I want to just kind of give everyone a quick rundown of what the Radix really is. I know it's been promoted as kind of a cross between Da Vinci Code and 24, but definitely it's definitely got a little more depth and action to it than both of those. That's where I thoroughly enjoyed it. Give us a little bit of your inspiration behind it, Brett.
Well, thank you, Matt. I really appreciate it. The Radix, it's about this legendary relic and that's thought to possess these extraordinary powers. And some of it really is. I would say about a third of the book is actually nonfiction. There's a little bit of history in there, a little bit of things pertaining to medicine, religion, and it also definitely psychology. My background, I am a psychologist, and there's definitely some of that in there too. And really kind of, I think it will appeal to people who enjoy a story that has historical mysteries and adventure and international suspense. It was a lot of fun to write.
Yeah, and then also John Brinstone, the hero, the main character,
right.
Kind of someone who's a kind of badass slash scholarly type, kind of an interesting hero that we haven't seen before either.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Brinstone very early in his life was stricken with a very severe illness. And this is actually based on, I'm a psychology professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And I had a student a few years ago who was this big, healthy guy, incredibly bright. And I was shocked to hear that when he was a boy, he had this disease that pretty much kept him in a wheelchair at times, certainly in a cast for many years. And he took that time to develop his mind. And he's actually relatively small. And then years later, after kind of conquering this disease, he came out of it and returned to school. And the kids were kind of like, whoa, look at this guy. I mean, because he was a big guy. And from then on, he kind of worked on developing his body, his fighting skills, things like that. And that was really the inspiration for Brinstone. I gave Brinstone the exact same disease that this former student of mine had. And then I'm also inspired by a good friend of mine, Kyler Storm, who was one of the finalists on the original American Gladiators. And Kyler is an inventor. He's probably the best athlete I've ever met in my life. He's an amazing guy. So Kyler and this former student, Matt, both created the dynamic that I used in putting together this badass scholar kind of guy that you're talking about.
Right. Well, I mean, you also mentioned a lot of nonfiction mixed in there. And so I, of course, Google Radix, and I don't find anything. But what I found more fascinating was the Voynich letters. Can you explain what they are and go in a little depth on that? Because there's definitely some quote-unquote celebrity that surrounds the Voynich letters. It's very interesting.
Absolutely. And I will say one thing. The Radix actually comes from, I take liberties with it, of course, in the name of fiction. But it really does come from alchemy, and I first discovered the term radix in the writings of the kind of mystical psychiatrist Carl Jung. He mentioned it in one of his books. I had never heard of it either until I came across it in Jung's writings. But back to your question about the Voynich manuscript. The Voynich manuscript is kind of the heart of the radix, the story. It's this mysterious document. It's a very real, mysterious medieval manuscript. It was discovered by a book dealer named Wilfred Voynich way back in 1912. And almost a century later, it has never been deciphered. I mean, some of the greatest professional code breakers in history have tried to crack this thing, have tried to weave through its tangle of all of these symbols. It's got these really strange stuff. I mean, some of the best minds from the KGB, the National Security Agency, the top British and American code breakers from World War II, they have all tried to break the code in the Voynich manuscript, and they've all failed. So it's either like a book of secret codes or one of the most sophisticated hoaxes in history. In short, it was a great place to bury some secrets about the Radix.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I was reading. I mean, the fact that it could be a hoax, I think they're kind of downplaying that. Like, it's too involved to be a hoax. But the fact that it's been around for hundreds of years and nobody can quite figure out is actually kind of cool.
Yeah, exactly. I think I would be kind of disappointed if it were a hoax. Just because it is so elaborate, they think it might have been developed actually by two different people, and it's been attributed to everyone from Leonardo da Vinci to Roger Bacon. We really don't know. I mean, it's fascinating, but it's just it amazes me that after almost a century of people studying this document, nobody has been able to figure it out. I mean, they haven't even come close. It's really a fascinating document.
And for everyone who's just tuning in, we're talking to Brett King. He's the author of The Radix. It has been out, released since May, so you can get it in ebook form through Amazon. You can go to your local bookstore and get it. Brett has been talking. We talked a little bit about fiction weaving with nonfiction, and we do get a lot of aspiring authors that listen, Brett. Can you talk a little about what it's like to actually combine the two as you're researching and writing and putting the two together?
Well, I just finished the sequel to The Radix, and not too long ago I heard an interview with Bono of the rock band U2, and Bono said you have a lifetime to record your first album and only a few months to record your second. That's kind of my story. I would work on and off on The Radix over the course of 3 or 4 years. I mean, I would, you know, I have 3 kids. And I actually started writing before I had kids. I call that the BC period of my life, before children. And I would just write in big marathons of 6 hours and things like that. Now I kind of have to write whenever I can write. But it was really, for me, so exciting to be able to just spend the time with this book. It went a lot of different directions. I have a terrific agent, Pam Ahern. She gave me a lot of wonderful suggestions that helped to shape and kind of focus the manuscript. And then in writing the sequel, it really did help me, because I had to write the sequel in about 8 or 9 months. And that made a huge difference, kind of developing that discipline from the first book. But I was struggling for a long time. I would flirt with writing on and off for many, many years, more than 10 years before I got a contract. And sometimes I took it seriously, you know, and sometimes I've also written textbooks and other nonfiction books. And so I wasn't always able to give it huge chunks of time, my fiction, that is. But the more I started writing the fiction, more it's become my passion. I mean, it's what I live for, along with my family. And it's just wonderful. I just have a blast doing it.
So Brett, this is John. I got a question for you, because we mentioned at the beginning, and I'm sure you heard off air, about Dorchester Publishing and what they're doing. And seeing as how it took you so long to maybe get that contract once the book was done, how do you feel about just going ahead right now and somebody saying, why wait 4, 5, 6, 7 years when I can publish my book on ebook right now and get it out there to the masses and let people start reading it?
Well, it is interesting that you mention all of this, because this all just kind of happened this week. I think it was on the 6th that Dorchester put this release out. And The Radix is actually published with Leisure, which is an imprint of Dorchester. And so I mentioned my second book is coming out. Now, I was under the impression that the book was going to be out in both mass market paperback as well as an e-version on December 28th. And on the 6th of August, I found out that, in fact, The Fault Store, which is the sequel to The Radix, will be released in an e-version first, because I am with Dorchester, at least for this second book. And it will actually then come out in not mass market. I mean, as we said, I think Dorchester is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, mass market paperback publisher out there. But Dorchester has kind of made this decision to kind of tighten and focus its distribution models. So it will actually be coming out in trade paperback, but not for a few months after the e-version. And, you know, I think it's a very bold experiment. It'll be very interesting to see where it goes. They feel that they're, of course, you know, Suspense Magazine, you guys have done a lot of things in the same direction, so this is kind of interesting to kind of keep an eye how this all plays out. But it's a very bold move, and, you know, right now it's just kind of a brave new world. I like to see experimentation, and I hope it works out well.
So your new book, is it going to be called The False Door? Is that
correct? Yes, that's right.
So if someone had not read The Radix, can they pick up from The False Door and pick up from, you know, what's going on there?
Yeah, they sure can. It's not only a series, it truly is a sequel, but I did write it in a way where John Brinstone and some of the other characters, if you have read the book, in fact, the first scene of The False Door literally picks up from the last scene of The Radix. So there's just like this continuous blend. But the majority of The False Door takes place 5 years after The Radix. However, if you haven't read The Radix, yeah, I really wrote that. I even, you know, kind of made sure that in talking with people that they could pick it up if they were not familiar with the first book. I had one person look at it who had not read The Radix, just to make certain that, you know, we were kind of, I actually had hoped to have more people, but just because of the crunch time and putting it out there, didn't get a chance to do that as much as I'd hoped. But yes, you should be able to pick up The False Door and get a sense of what happened. And hopefully, but without revealing too many things in the ratings, hopefully, I love my plot twists. And I tried to protect those as much as I could from the Radix if you haven't read it. And hopefully it will make people interested in reading the Radix if they haven't already.
Hey, Brett, this is John again. And I just want to mention to everybody here that this is Brett King, author of the Radix, that's on the phone with us right now. We got about 9 minutes left. If you want to call in, it's 877-666-9320. And we have a couple chat room questions here, so I'm going to get to the first one. So the first chat room question is, How do you balance job, writing, and your family? Do you have like some kind of dark room that you kind of go into and say, leave me alone? Or what do you do?
Well, I wish I could say I do it gracefully, but I don't. I don't do it gracefully. I just gave up sleep pretty much. Just got rid of sleep, and I do write when the kids go to bed. And every once in a while, I do escape like to a local library down in my office. But I really love kids, and it's so hard. I mean, my writing always takes second place to my kids and my wife. And she actually helps me. My wife, Sherry, is also a psychologist, and she's my first reader. She's a terrific editor. She always, gives me a lot of insights. So that really helps out a lot when they're at school. I mean, fortunately, I have a job where in the falls I teach Tuesday, Thursday, and in the spring I teach Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And even though I teach about 800 students a semester, and I also have 4 online courses, so I teach about 10 college courses a year plus 4 online courses, it doesn't leave too much time. And so I don't follow sports the way I used to.
Oh, my Lord.
Yes, I know.
Brett. And that's all right. The Broncos aren't any good anyway. So is Colorado.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't really miss too much with the Broncos, although they did start out really well. I was working on the fall store last fall, and I thought, this is going to be a good year to skip. And then they started out so well, so I started watching a couple of games, and then they went in the toilet. So, karma came back and got me at some point there. But no, not very gracefully. I just kind of write. I wish I could say, like Jim Rollins, he talks about how he writes 4 hours every morning and then reads for several hours every night. And, I mean, it's haphazard. It's chaotic. But out of all the chaos, it keeps it interesting. There's never a dull moment by any means.
So here's another question that we got off. They want to know what authors are on your bookshelves.
Oh, wow. For a long time, because I was a psychologist, I actually read much more nonfiction than fiction. That's not the case anymore. I mean, one of the joys about writing fiction is I get to read fiction and I don't feel guilty about it. But among thrillers, I love Lee Child. I mentioned Jim Rollins a minute ago, Steve Barry, Brad Meltzer, Clive Cussler, Child and Preston, Brad Thor. Outside of thrillers, I like Stephen King and Neil Gaiman, Elmore Leonard, and outside of, some of that stuff, John Updike, Joyce Carol Oates. Probably my all-time favorite writer goes back to when I was younger it'd be tough between Edgar Allan Poe and Mark Twain. Those were the first authors that I became crazy about, where I was just almost obsessive and wanting to read what they wrote and learn about them. And so Sam Clemens and Edgar Allan Poe, probably, if you put a gun to my head, those would have to be the two all-time biggest faves for me.
Hey, Brett, so I was reading an article that you had talked about you suffered from nightmares and writing kind of helped the nightmares disappear. Can you talk about how bad the nightmares were? Were they reoccurring? Is that too personal? I mean, that's kind of a scary thing right there.
Yeah, it makes me sound a little bit weird, and there's a good reason why, because I am a little bit weird. I mean, I'm a psychologist, go figure. It's true. As a little kid, Robinson Crusoe, his character of Friday, for some reason, in the Robinson, not his character, but when I was reading Robinson Crusoe, the character of Friday used to terrorize me in these nightmares. I would just, for some reason, when I read Robinson Crusoe, it just really affected me in a very negative kind of way. And so I kind of had these night terrors, and they would continue on. And my poor wife, she's had to see me. I mean, I've had all kinds of stuff. I dreamed that there was a 9-foot-tall black angel in my bedroom, and I always want to fight him for some reason. This makes me sound really weird, but I got into a pillow fight. My wife woke up to find me standing on my bed swinging a pillow at this black angel, and God knows what that was about. I mean, I've studied psychology and Freud and Jung, but I have no clue what that symbolism means. And then another time I saw all these little weird robots. They kind of look like vacuum, like those Roombas from hell. And they were like just swirling around my bedroom floor. And I'm always wanting to attack these things. I don't just sit there and scream at them. I always want to, I'm very proactive with my nightmares. And so I jumped on the floor and I was trying to tackle them. And then the next morning, I mean, I was wrestling with him. My poor wife just thinks, what's wrong with this guy? And then the next morning, I slide on my Levi's, and my knees hurt and my elbows hurt when I put on my shirt. I realized I had rug burns from trying to wrestle these imaginary, you know, little creatures, these robot things on my floor. So, but the weird thing is when I started writing fiction, they've all stopped. So it's a lot cheaper than psychotherapy. It's like I think I just have this dark imagination, and when I give it an outlet of writing fiction, it just goes away. And there was a period where I had to write the fourth edition of my textbook on the history of psychology. So I had to stop writing fiction for about 8 months, and I had some pretty hellish nightmares. I mean, now all of you listeners really do think I am insane. So, but, yeah, that's it. There's more. I can tell you
writing.
More over drinks.
Yeah, okay. keep writing. Get rid of the nightmares because we want more.
That's right.
From you.
That's right.
Well, you mentioned a lot about the nonfiction, and you read a lot, and you've written a couple nonfiction pieces as well. You've done some sports psychology. I mean, what level have you done the sports psychology to?
Well, I've always had my PhD is actually in forensic psychology, and but I really am a general psychologist. My master's thesis was on memory. My doctoral dissertation was on forensic psychology. I've studied sports psychology. I'm very interested in performance and athleticism, how those go hand in hand in terms of things like visualization. In fact, in The False Door, John Brinstone uses visualization that is classic sports psychology. He's in kind of a bad situation,
really?
as he always seems to be in my books. And he uses some basic mental visualization to kind of get him out of it. And then I've also published an article on the history of sports psychology, the way that sports psychology kind of evolved back in the 1800s in cultural magazines like the Atlantic Monthly and Ladies' Home Journal, of all things. That's actually kind of where sports psychology began with these early psychologists.
Yeah, I actually worked with Ken Revisa back in college. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Yes, of course. That's amazing. Really, that's great.
Yeah, now we're sidetracking a little bit. But I think John, I thought John had another chat room question for you. But
yeah,
I just want to remind everyone as we're kind of narrowing down here at the interview, if you want to learn more about Brett, you can always go to his website at authorbrettking.com. That's two T's in Brett. And you're also going to see that he has some sightings on his website versus signings. So does that mean, I don't know if that means he's just going to pop in and pop out. But I have one more question actually related is for people that are trying to promote their books, as we're talking ebooks, do you have any suggestions for what people could and should do to help promote their novels?
Well, I think social networking is key. I mean, I know some people don't agree with me. I just got back from Thriller Fest. I know you guys were there at Thriller Fest. Suspense Magazine had a great presence there, which is, you know, this terrific meeting of thriller writers. Some people call it a three-day cocktail party for thriller writers, but it was just this wonderful experience. And some people I know don't believe in social networking. It's been terrific for me. It's a great venue for me. I really love it. And, you know, I believe in doing these book signings. I've talked to some authors who believe that. I mean, I'm doing book signings on until October. We haven't posted them all on the website yet. But I'll be doing book signings until October. And, you know, it is true you go there and sometimes you only sell. I just had one up in a little mountain town Saturday. It was terrific. And we sold about 14 books. But you really get to talk to people about what their interests are. And it was a table signing. I wasn't speaking. This weekend I'm going to be doing one where I'm talking in Grand Junction, Colorado, and signing. But you really do get a chance to interact with people, see what their interests are. You get a chance to know the bookstore owners. And for me, that's invaluable. That is really terrific. Yeah, it does take some time, but I think, you know, just don't be afraid to get out there and promote yourself, promote your work. It doesn't come naturally to me to go on and on and on about what I've done. I mean, that's my mom always kind of raised me to, you know, she always used to say, don't blow your own horn, let someone else, you know, kind of talk about what you're doing. I've always tried to do that. But it's kind of uncomfortable at first, but, you know, if you really believe in your product and your book and you want to get out there and share with people, it's very exciting. And I just love to talk to readers. Readers are just terrific people to interact with.
Well,
tonight. And are you guys there? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I just want to go ahead. I just want to say, great having you on here tonight. It's been such a joy. I want everyone to go out and get the book Radix. I want everyone to go find it, go search for Brett, and we're going to bring you back on, Brett, here for the SmackDown tonight, so you can start thinking about what that's going to be and, you know, who you're going to go for. So, Brett, hey, thank you so much again.
Thanks so much, John, man. Andy Gross, of course, is an amazing guy. It's going to be a tribute.
He is on hold right now. We're going to bring him right on.
And excellent, excellent. Thank you so much.
All right. So speaking of that, I want to introduce the best-selling author, Andrew Gross, of his latest book, Reckless. So, Andrew, how are you doing tonight? Thank you so much for joining us here.
How are you? Here on East Coast time, it's like 9:30. Already been out, had a bottle of wine, watching the Yankee game. So I have a little less energy than your previous guest, but ready to roll.
That's okay. That's okay. I want to just jump right in here, and I want to jump right in with your book, Reckless, because this is the third book that you've written about Ty, and I might maybe pronounce it right, Ty Hawk?
Hawk, yeah.
Okay. And so how is the progression of Ty and Reckless been since you first wrote him in The Dark Tide?
Well, you know, when I did him in The Dark Tide, I had no concept, actually, that I was creating a series. So I was really just going for a character who I thought carried a little tragedy with him and you know, was sort of reinventing his life by moving from New York to a suburban town of Greenwich, Connecticut, which is an affluent town and, you know, full of bankers and CEOs and hedge fund guys and, you know, lots of elements of corruption and things like this happening there. So, you know, I put him in a situation where he basically, to me, it was never his book. It was this character Karen's book. And you know, Ty was just a guy that, over the course of trying to solve her own issues, sort of fell in love with her. And gradually, I guess, as books change, it really became his story in many ways and his own transformation back into a whole person. So, you know, here he is two books later in Reckless. You know, Lee Child has a good formula, which basically is, if you're going to do a series character, how do you keep it fresh, and how do you ultimately not make it predictable either through setting or you know, character? And so he's got this guy that ends up in a different venue every single book, and so you're never getting the same thing. And so, you know, to me, the challenge is always, how do you keep writing and basically add freshness to a series character? To be completely honest with you, I get bored with series. I don't really enjoy them. On the other hand, a lot of people totally love them and love the predictability and the comfort of certain characters. So, you know, anyway, I mean, the guy has gone through a lot of changes and maybe a couple of gals, although I think his heart is in the right place. He's, you know, I think he's a gal that women like, and so he's an honorable guy, but he does seem to have an attraction. Women seem to be attracted to him, and he finds them. And so basically what I did in Reckless is, you know, I didn't want the guy to be a policeman forever, because I'm not sure how many of your readers have been to Greenwich, but there's only so much stuff you can credibly, you know,
right.
it can happen there. So anyway, I sort of have moved him and put him as a partner in a global consulting company and a security company. And so that's where he is in this book.
So, and then right now, you know, Reckless is available, and I want to let everybody know that we're speaking with Andrew Gross. And if you want to call in and ask him something, please do so at 877-666-9320, and we'll do our best to get you on. And so we were at Thriller Fest, and we met you there, and we saw your class of how to write supporting characters. And you just mentioned, as far as, you know, Lee Child having a great recipe for having the hero continue on, and I think a lot of people like to follow the hero because they sort of maybe start becoming part of their life when they're just waiting for that next book to come out. But you do a tremendous job of your supporting characters, and I think that was a great lesson that you gave everyone. Is that one of your, I guess you want to say, one of your fortes that you're with your books is, you know, supporting character is definitely something that you focus extremely hard on?
Yeah, I mean, I like to write rich novels. I don't like to write, you know, necessarily hero-based novels. So to me, yeah, it's vital. because, you know, anytime you put a character on stage, if you don't handle them well, you're basically inviting the reader to say, this doesn't work for me, or to basically question how deftly, you know, you do your work. So to me, you know, I love, you know, I don't want to go through my presentation there, but it's, you know, I love the surprise of minor characters in a book. And to me, it's not always, you know, it's, I think I threw out there that it's sort of like the TV comedy show thing of, you know, give me your best TV, your favorite TV comedy shows, whether it's Seinfeld or Frasier or whatever, and tell me who your favorite character is. And it's rarely the guy whose name is on the, you know, is on the credit. It's always the Niles characters, or George Costanza. So to me, the richness of a book comes from how smaller characters are. So yeah, it's important to me, but it's no more important than paces. It's no more important than investing your reader, you know, in the book quickly. Because you know, coming out of the Patterson School, I like pages to turn. I like to write page turners. So you know, but it's part of it. But it all goes towards, you know, I think the quality of an experience in a book.
Hey Andrew, this is Matt. Definitely, I was a Niles fan on that show. It's funny you mentioned that. I've got a couple questions for you from the chat room.
Sure.
And one of which is, what was the inspiration behind the shoes for Reckless?
behind the shoes, I think if I know what it's referring to, my son for a birthday present, somewhat belatedly, because it came out long after the book. I was sort of, you know, not promoting the book, but got me a pair of Nikes that someone had doctored up to look exactly like the Reckless cover. So it was pretty cool. And, you know, so in any case, I actually got them during Thriller Fest. So I allowed myself a day to wear them. But basically, that's what it is. Now, I don't know. They're in the closet, and who knows if they'll ever come out again and see the light of day. But in any case, they're pretty awesome. As a matter of fact, I think I'm going to have him do it on the next one in a more timely way. So I think I have a picture up on my website, or certainly Facebook or something, that shows them. But it's pretty cool. It's just a complete replica, perfect replica, color-wise and graphic-wise, of the cover. So.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Another question for you is, you wrote an article, Pace, in Suspense Magazine, and
mm-hmm.
something you've always used in your writing. Is it something you've always used in your writing, or is it a culmination of what you've learned that works or not through your years of writing?
No, I mean, I like pages to turn. I you know, my whole thing as a writer is to grab people really early on, literally in the first, you know, 10 pages of a book, if not even sooner. I want them immediately. So to me, you know, pace is, you know, I guess, without sort of getting too, you know, writerly about it, everything in a book is a trade-off to me. You can achieve, if you have a certain ability, you can achieve almost anything with it, but ultimately it's what you're going for. And if you're going for pages to move, then whatever you put in there as part of the formula, whether it's backstory or whether it's scene setting or et cetera, it all does what? It all sort of, you know, goes against the pace of the book. Now, a certain amount of it adds texture and is right, but too much of it begins to slow it down. So, you know, to me, what's important is that I keep pages turning. And one of the issues, or one of the fights that I always have with my editor sometimes, is that they'd like more. In the terms of certain things, and I say, you know, I don't know. You know, to me, what is essential in keeping the story going is what is right for the book, and anything else to me is just sort of writerly artifice. So I generally shy away from it. But you know, obviously, if it's too thin, and not to name names, but someone I wrote 6 books with, let's say, whose initials are JP, you sometimes, you know, without. without sitting in judgment of his extraordinary success, sometimes you can finish a book and go, okay, so what? So, you know, it can't be too much to either extreme. But I am a pace guy, and it's important to me, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, Reckless is definitely a book, when we read it, was definitely the page turner. And if you had to kind of sit there and say, for someone who might not have read either The Dark Tide, which is the first Ty Hawk book, Don't Look Twice, and now Reckless, Would you suggest that maybe they start at the Dark Tide and read the three up, or can they jump right into Reckless and maybe
right
work
in.
Their way back?
Yeah, they can jump right in. I like the Dark Tide. It's a book that everybody seems to like. It's got, you know, a really appealing female, strong-willed female person, and there's Ty Houck, and it's his origins as a character. Reckless is a book that's very timely, in that it was really written about a conspiracy behind the financial meltdown. It's not a financial book. You certainly don't need an MBA to read my stuff. But it does sort of put bankers or the people that control our government financially, I think, in a sort of a dubious light. And, you know, who's easier to hate these days than, you know, CEOs of banks or hedge fund managers? So, you know, it's got easy sort of bad guys in it. And so you know, they're both easy, but ultimately they're really stories of of murder solved and how, you know, all of my stories sort of start with a local event, whether it's a hit and run accident, whether it's a bomb that, you know, is on the Metro North train going into Manhattan. And in this case, in the case of Reckless, it's sort of a real tragic triple murder that took place, was built off in a real event that took place up near us in Connecticut, where a mom and two daughters were killed. And it sort of builds off of that, and they start local, and they grow globally. So one of the things I learned from Patterson is if you're going to start with a traffic ticket, don't end up in traffic court. You know, your stories have to grow. They have to widen. There has to be something really important at stake. And I think in Reckless, it's, although 350 pages of the 400-some-odd pages are really about someone trying to solve a specific murder, ultimately, at the end, it grows into this sort of, you know, intense global conspiracy. So you can start anywhere. I mean, that's the thing about these sort of books. I don't really mean for them to be read chronologically, and you can pick it anywhere you want.
Well, you know, it's funny because a lot of, when you write something and you get it out there, and a lot of authors, then you'd have like, 6 to 8 months or maybe 12 months before another book comes out, but then people pick it up day one. And so the chat room was buzzing because I think you have a lot of fans out there that have read Reckless, because now they're saying, okay, you did Reckless. Now, what are you working on now? What's coming next? And it's like, come on, the poor guy just put it out.
It's a totally different book for me. It has nothing to do with Ty Houck. It has nothing to do with the kind of stuff I've been writing. I did have a family tragedy in my family that took place last July, where a nephew who was a very troubled kid, bipolar, was released from a mental hospital in California, actually. This took place in San Luis Obispo, and walked out and climbed the Mara Bay Rock in Mara Bay and jumped off. And
So, sadly,
nonetheless, I've sort of taken this the personal story and turned it into a thriller that, I don't really do dark books, and this isn't a dark book, but it's maybe the creepiest book I've done. But basically, it's about a similar event that ultimately leads into a 30-year-old vendetta of sort of a Manson-type crime. So it's a completely different story, but it's not going to disappoint anybody. It's a pretty solid story, and I think one of the trademarks of my books, I think, is that they're very emotionally resonant, and I think this one is a very compelling book, won't be any different. So totally different, total departure from it.
That had to be something that was just probably extremely difficult to maybe just start getting down on the pages when you say dark, but I mean, that's a place that you've never been before. That had to be just extremely difficult.
It is, and there's a lot of family in this book, and there's a lot of anecdotes in the book that are part of the lore of my family and things that we've all sort of gone through. So to me, it's a much more personal book than I've ever written. But at the same time, I think the story is engrossing, the pages move, and there's an emotional payoff at the end. And on the next book, the book after this, I may leave Ty Houck again and do something else. It's sort of, in a different way, but on the same theme, I was on book tour in Houston for Reckless a couple of months ago, and I somehow found myself handcuffed and arrested by the Houston police for making an illegal turn, and then events sort of blew up from there. So as writers do, I found a way to sort of use this for my own purposes. So I figure if you're going to go through that sort of thing, you might as well turn it into a book. So that's sort of how the next book is going to begin.
Okay, now that's funny. So you're going to be doing with the cops on that one. So hey, that's what I call definitely falling right into your work on that one.
You know, art mirrors life for sure.
Exactly. So now the chat rooms have a couple questions here that I'm going to ask because they kind of have an understanding because they know it must be a difficult thing to do. But, you know, was it difficult when, you know, you might not be a little bit different with your writing styles with James Patterson? Was that kind of difficult for you guys to, like, sync up together?
Probably was on the first book. By the time the sixth book ended, I don't think I knew what my writing style was anymore. And, you know, but I mean, I didn't think it was difficult, but I think he might say it was, at least on the first one. I think the leash was fairly short. Don't forget, I was his first co-writer. So it was
right.
A new experience for him and clearly for me. And I tried very hard to sort of adapt myself to his style and his pace. But I think over time, that's how I grew to write, and I didn't even know any other way. So, you know, multi-books in, it was no issue. And certainly my leash got enormously longer after the first book to the point where on the sixth book, you know, I think his trust was there, and I was, you know, altering plots at will to a large degree and, you know, from his outlines and whatever sort of felt right. So it was a matter of time, and it was a matter of trust and experience.
And when I'm sitting here and I'm reading your bio, I'm trying to kind of understand how you kind of made the transformation of, you know, being from marketing background where you did major in English, but then you had a marketing background, and then you came in, and then you said, okay, how did you kind of take from where you were at on there and then just jump right into, I'm just going to start writing? Because obviously the passion was probably still there during the whole time.
Well, I mean, I didn't just have a marketing background. I actually was in the women's apparel business and actually got into the ski and tennis business and ended up running a couple of companies that people would be familiar with, like Head, which was a global company, and another one called Le Coq Sportif. But, yeah, clearly my resume wasn't exactly supporting my first, introduction into doing this. But I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't know how to answer the question. I felt I could do it, like a lot of people. In most cases, it's probably a recipe for family catastrophe. In my case, I brought enough to the table, and I believed in myself, and I think my business experience absolutely helped me in life. I was, you know, very success-oriented. I was very goal-oriented. I wasn't bullshitting myself. I audited myself constantly, like a process of continuous improvement as well. I took classes not to learn how to write, but to gauge myself whether I was in a delusion that I could do this, figuring if I can't, you know, get to the top of a 12-person writer's class, how am I going to get a book published? So, you know, all along the way, I was sort of given the encouragement to go forward. And, you know, like a lot of people, you learn your craft. And while I was okay when I started and good enough to attract Patterson, I think I'm obviously a much more, you know, much better writer now. And, like, you know, hopefully it's an upward line, not a downward line. So like anything, you learn how to do it better and quicker and with more skill and finesse. So I don't know. I don't really know where it came from. I edited the literary magazine in college. I was a published poet when I was in high school, and that's sort of how I ended up at Middlebury and had the support of the program there. But ultimately, that doesn't really mean a hill of beans. So, for whatever it is, I had the break that a lot of people dream of when I had a book that didn't make the cut on my own, but it got into Patterson's hands, and he called up and basically said, you know, you got the goods. So without that, I'd probably be back in the women's apparel business.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, Andrew, it's been great having you on. I just have to say one more thing here real quick before we let you go, because your character in your debut novel, The Blue Zone. Her name is Kate Robb, and not related to me though. But
okay.
I was like, you know, wow, that's the first time that everyone's even ever wrote Robb before like that. And I'm like, well, maybe she could be related. So that's just kind of interesting. I just had to kind of put that out because I was just like,
you
Kate Robb.
I won't.
I'm going to right now because I have a lot of family on the East Coast, so I'm going to claim Kate Robb as my long lost, I never met.
You know something? I'm not going to tell on you, so it works for me.
Well, Andrew, I'm going to tell everyone right now, go out, pick up the book Reckless. You can find Andrew on andrewgrossbooks.com. It's his official website. Reckless is the book, along with his one before that he had, Don't Look Twice, The Dark Tide, and The Blue Zone, which was his solo debut, came out. So, Andrew, it's been great. Thank you so much for coming on. And we cannot wait to see the next book. Now letting us know what it's about. So I think it's fascinating.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having
me. All right, thank you.
Okay.
Bye bye. Bye. So we're gonna go ahead now, and we are going to jump right into our next segment, which is the ever popular.
I'm already giving you instructions in the dressing room. I expect a tough, clean fight. Protect yourself at all times. We're waiting for the challenge. Champion, now get it on!
All right, so here we go. We're going to go ahead and jump right into the SmackDown segment here. Andrew had to leave, and so he's not going to be a part of this one this time. But we're going to go ahead and we're going to make it a threesome between me, Matt, and Brett. I don't know if I can say it on the air. And we're going to go ahead and we're going to go against Agatha Christie versus Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and I'm going to go to you, Brett, and I'm going to say, who are you going with?
Well, first let me say this is my first threesome, so I'm very excited. This is fascinating.
Nice.
For me, and I have some friends out there that probably won't speak to me anymore and will send me death threats because I have some friends that are huge Agatha Christie fans. I know she's the queen of mystery, and she's awesome and all that, but for me, Arthur Conan Doyle, he's all alone up there, and not just because of Sherlock Holmes. I mean, obviously, Sherlock Holmes alone is enough to just send him up there, but for me, early on, when I read the Professor Challenger stories, if your readers, they're probably familiar, George Edward Challenger is kind of a little bit pretentious, very brilliant, just like Holmes, and his books are often, the short stories are often, considered to be science fiction in the Challenger series. But for me, I think they're thrillers, and they very much set the tradition for my character of John Brinstone, for James Rollins' characters of Sigma Force. I mean, I think for a lot of thriller writers. So for me, no question.
Okay. Well, I'm telling you, I'm going to go ahead of Matt because he kind of got me on the hero-villain thing, and I was like, thanks a lot. So I'm going here, and I'm going Agatha Christie. Hands down, it's Agatha Christie. And so, Matt, who are you going with?
Well, I think some people might argue there's more depth to her characters, like Poirot, but most people, forget that he had a assistant, Hastings, and everything was Agatha Christie actually said she was influenced by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. It was the inspiration behind it. Sherlock Holmes, just sticking with that theme, he seemed to be the one who could deduce things more into more depth. I've got to go with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, hands down.
Okay, well, you're both wrong, because, and I'm just telling you straight up, first of all, you're both wrong. Agatha Christie is not only, I think, more in-depth because she does have more than one character, but when you look over the shows and the movies and the things that were inspired, Murder, She Wrote was inspired by almost all of Agatha Christie's. When you have Death on the Nile, Murder on the Orient Express, Then There Were None, Evil Under the Sun, all those books that became great, great movies. And then A&E, I believe it is, with the Hercule Poirot series and then the Miss Jane Marple series and all of that. I mean, Sherlock Holmes, I will say, is probably the grandfather that maybe gave Agatha Christie some of the start, but I think that she perfected what the mystery is, and she is definitely the standard. When you go out and purchase a mystery book, it's going to say on the back, it's not going to, it's going to tell people, fans of Agatha Christie are going to love this. you know, I don't know if you see that as much as, you know, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and maybe he's just kind of a forgotten piece because, you know, I don't know. But I think that with hands down, I think it's Agatha Christie is the better mystery writer.
You didn't really explain how we were wrong.
Yeah,
you're wrong.
Okay. For that too.
I don't have to explain why you're wrong. All I got to do is just say Agatha Christie's better. That in turn makes you wrong because you picked the wrong person. You know, I don't have to go in why you're wrong. It's like I'm right, and then that's why you're wrong. You know.
Well, for me, I mean, Conan Doyle was a man of science, and he was a physician. And I just, I mean, I like that too. Like I said, the Challenger, I mean, you said that Conan Doyle had only one character, but like I said, the Professor Challenger, for me, is outstanding. I mean, I think he's terrific. I mean, it's a little dated, but I think it's a wonderful character.
But remember, and also Sherlock Holmes had Moriarty, where Agatha Christie never had a nemesis. She didn't
She didn't have a memorable nemesis, is what you're saying.
Well, because her detectives could stand on their own in each point and didn't need to have some nemesis to come in and kind of shake things up with, you know, Sherlock Holmes and the detective in the story. She didn't need to have that. And the chat room is agreeing with me, and not just because maybe there's probably more women listening, but because Agatha Christie's better.
Just because she has better movies doesn't make her a better author either. You want
the movie thing, too. No, that's true, but... Go ahead.
I think having a good antagonist is as important in some cases as having a good protagonist. And again, off the top of my head, and I can't say I've only read one of the Miss Marvels, but I can't think of the name of one of the antagonists in any of Agatha. And she's great. She is awesome. But
you don't need
Sherlock,
to have the antagonist. You don't need to have that in there. So I don't think you do. But I'll tell you what, we only got about 3 or so minutes left here. And I'm going to give this to you. I'm going to say that the chat room is going Agatha Christie hands down over Sherlock Holmes and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. But, yeah, okay, Agatha Christie wins because the chat room won, and I'm sorry for you too. I was going to try to make it a tie, but I can't go against what the fans say, and they're saying that it's Agatha Christie. So,
I'm sure Andy Gross would have said Conan Doyle. Does that help? That doesn't help, does it?
No, it doesn't. But I do want to go like this. I want to say, Brett, we only got a couple minutes left. We're going to wrap it up. Thank you so much for being on the show. And everybody, it's The Radix by Brett King. That's K-I-N-G. You can't mispronounce that one. So Brett King. And everyone go out, find the book, buy the book, because you're going to love it. So I want to say, Brett, thank you so much for being on. It was great. And, you know, you're welcome back when The False Door comes out. We'd love to have you on and see what's going on. So...
Well, thank
you
very
much.
One. Thank you so much. It was great to visit with both of you and the listeners. And, yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much. Love your magazine, like I said before. It's terrific to see that there's, you know, a dedication to the mystery thriller kind of genre with your work. So keep up the great work.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Brett. You have a good one.
Thank you. Take care. Good night, guys.
All right. Bye.
Great show, John. Two great authors that gave us a lot of
time. These hours get a little shorter and shorter, so we're going to have to make this one quick and say Friday night show is Jocelyn Drake and Stephen White here right on air at 6 o'clock Pacific time, 9 o'clock Central. So don't forget to check out that one, suspensemagazine.com. Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. So look for it, and Matt, it was great, and, you know, we're going to be back here on Friday.
Sounds good. Look forward to it. See everyone then.
All right, so until Friday, yeah, I always got to leave you with something. Tonight I'm going to leave you with this.